market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, the very special Dr. Nirban Mahanty. How are you, Doc?
Very good. Always excited to answer mailbag questions.
Me too, mate. It's always very exciting. For those who haven't listened before, this is our regular Sunday mailbag. It was originally kind of a bonus episode every now and again, and we got so many great questions that we keep answering them. And so it's kind of gone from being the occasional to the expected. We still call it our special edition, but, it's a... It's still a special, just a little more regular. Mate, let's get straight into it. I want to start with some feedback. This is going to give us a massive rap, and I do care. I don't want to seem to other people like we're just giving ourselves a rap, but I want to pass on some comments from Bernard, because if you haven't listened before or you're not sure about this whole Motley Fool thing, that's a nice way to put it in perspective, mate. So this is going to be largely a comment, but let's go with it. He actually addresses Zoe, one of our wonderful member services fools, who replied to an email he sent previously. Bernard says, "Hi, Zoe. Please pass on my thanks to Scott and Anirban for answering my questions on the podcast. They always give me something to think about, and I really appreciate they take all questions seriously and they consider their responses even when they are newbie responses from people like me. I am so grateful to the whole Fool organization. I think the Fools in America and Australia help to democratize stock investing. As someone who was born poor, with no one in the family knowing anything about stocks or stock investing, I'm amazed that the Fool business model includes giving away great financial suggestions and information to people for free. Yes, of course, people can subscribe to services, but even if they couldn't, they could listen to all the podcasts for free, get useful, actionable, and prudent stock information, and invest whatever money they have based on the suggestions. And I think they'd still do better than the S&P or the ASX. With so many sharks out there in the finance world, from hedge funds prepared to manipulate the market through lies and deceptions, through to small-scale stock scammers, which my wife and I got stung by, sorry to hear it, Bernard, it's a relief to have an organization like The Fool be transparent and decent when it comes to investing. I can't thank the Fools enough for the huge change in my family's future they have contributed to." And this is the bit I wanted to add, mate, because Bernard says, "You see, it's hard investing one out. Self-doubt, i.e. fear, greed, misinformation, anchoring, confirmation bias, losing focus, chasing losses, lack of diversity, market gyrations, and outright market manipulations, short attacks, value traps, etc. And I could include more," he says in brackets, "all work to make it hard to stay focused and motivated to stay invested for the long term. For me, the Fools help keep me focused, lower my fears, and give me confidence and energy to do this for the long haul. I'm so grateful. I've thought about buying a subscription for one stranger who listens to the podcast, but who can't afford a subscription. But I figured if they couldn't afford the sub, they probably wouldn't be able to afford to buy stocks. I don't know." That's very kind, mate. "Anyway, thanks again to all of you. By the way," he says, "there's a lot of shade thrown at the Motley Fool online. Those comments kept me away from the Fool for more than a year. Had it not been for the podcast and Motley Fool transparency, I'd probably still be out there trying to work out this investing stuff myself and probably underperforming the market. Sorry for my long comment. Fool on, Bernard." So I just wanted to share that. Yes, it's giving us a wrap, but what I wanted to do is do it because it's one thing for us to say, hey, we're cool, come and try us out, and I think people should. But I wanted to give just a genuine comment from someone who, frankly, is, as I said, Bernard's obviously a lovely bloke. He's even thinking about, you know, paying for someone else to subscribe to the services to make sure they can get some value from it too, which I think is wonderful. We won't take him up on the offer, mate, because, it's not... But the thought is there, the comment is there, and I just thought it was worth people hearing from someone other than us why they might consider at least listening longer, if not joining one of our services. Do you have any thoughts on that, mate, or we just keep going?
No, I think it's wonderful, and thank you very much.
Beautiful. Thanks, Bernard. All right, here's a question from B. B doesn't give us their name, so it's just B. B with a capital B. "Hi, Fools. Thanks for all the sage advice, as always. I'm a happy member of Share Advisor, Extreme Opportunities, Stock Advisor, and Rule Breakers." Those last two, of course, are our US services. B says, "But my favorite source of info is, of course, the podcast." There we go. See, we don't get enough random, positive, unexpected praise, do we, mate? "Undue praise is my favorite type, so B, thank you. A lot of people ask about buying US shares. So first, a tip for your listeners." Here we go. "CMC Markets have zero brokerage on US, UK, Japanese, and Canadian stocks if you purchase a $100,000 minimum lot. ASX trades are at $11, so they are an excellent option, and I'm surprised they never get a mention. I also have a CompSec account. To be honest, I can't see any noticeable difference between the two. So why pay higher fees? Hashtag get a better rate. And no, I am no way affiliated with CMC." I'll take that as a comment, B. Thank you. B says, "I was looking into Nintendo, which is a past recommendation of one of your US services. but discovered that the US stock is OTC or over the counter, and so I can't buy it through my broker. I looked at the Japanese stock, but there is a minimum 100 share limit, which works out to about $76,000 Australian. A little rich for my blood at the moment, says B. So my only option is to buy Nintendo. Seems to be a UK listed ADR, or I don't think it probably is an ADR because that's an American depository receipt, but in any case, a US derivative of the Japanese company. So I've got some questions, B says. Can you explain what an over-the-counter stock is? Two, what is the 100 Japanese stock limit all about? Am I right in assuming there's a completely arbitrary number and applies the same to a $1 stock and a $1,000 stock? And three, is it owning an ADR any different to owning the underlying stock apart from any drift in pricing? Thanks, fools. B. I like this doc because it was, we don't get asked about Japanese stocks very often. It also gives us a chance to talk a little bit about some of the jargon and hopefully decode some of it for some of our listeners like B who may not know. Mate, you are our resident overseas stock expert. I certainly have a decent number of US stocks as well, but you are far more active in the US market than I am. So I'm going to throw it to you first. Can you explain to B what an over-the-counter stock is?
Yeah, so an over-the-counter effectively is a security that doesn't really trade on a formal exchange, mm-hmm. right? So these are things that trade via, like, you know, there's like a dealer network, and so it's not mm-hmm. governed by, for example, NASDAQ or NYSE, so mm-hmm. to speak, right? So that's an over-the-counter stock. Typically, these would be the US-listed versions or variants, or these are ways of providing access to foreign stocks mm-hmm. or foreign companies to U.S. investors, and typically those would be OTCs or companies that basically, you know, OTC companies, again, they effectively don't have to follow the same guidelines in terms of disclosures and things like that for NYSE and NASDAQ. So that's basically the main difference is, are you listed on a formal exchange? Are you listed on sort of like a quasi exchange? Nice. Is the main difference. The thing to point out is there may be companies which have shares trading on another country's exchange, mm-hmm. which may have. So, for example, a lot of Australian, and I shouldn't say a lot, but many Australian companies have OTC shares trading in the US. Mm-hmm. Similarly, for example, I believe there is OTC. So this Nintendo thing is an OTC. So Nintendo trades on the Japanese market, yeah. and you can buy sort of an effective, you can get exposure to that, the Nintendo shares via the OTC shares. I think a few others, there are some companies that are listed on, say, Hong Kong, which have OTC shares mm. available in the US. So
European
that's
companies as well, I think, from memory. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are quite a few. I personally,
what are the pros and cons, mate? What should B or other listeners think about OTC ideas generally?
So, you know, like more of, you know, like, okay, so if you're buying an OTC in a company that's listed in another country which is governed by, you know, rules of the laws that you sort of are comfortable with, then maybe the risks are low. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the ones that I stay away definitely from are OTC shares of companies that are basically, that's their only listing. Right. And those, I think, are higher risk because the disclosure rules don't apply. The other thing to realize with things like Nintendo and so on and so forth would be that, you know, you'd have to effectively get the disclosure from their IR page. It's not a big deal here, but for some things, it might be a big deal. So I don't buy OTC for a very different reason. If I have ever tried to buy an OTC share, I think on Schwab, which is what I primarily use, then the trading fees are actually pretty high.
Right.
Okay. So brokerage fees are high, and that's just, you know, been one of those things. Well, that, you know, I just don't want to pay that much in brokerage. It's not exorbitantly high, but it's not like, you know, Schwab is basically zero. This one is like, I think, like $50 or something like that. So I don't want to pay $50 to buy
shares.
That's high
for US stock, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's sort of the main, and OTC is not the same thing as ADR, right? So ADR yeah. is American Depositary Receipts, which basically means that somebody deposits X number of shares of the company. So those shares of that company. So for a good example might be, there aren't any ADRs, I believe, for, say, Afterpay. But mm-hmm. if somebody wanted to make Afterpay ADRs available in the US, what they would do is they would buy a chunk of Afterpay shares and then hold it in trust somewhere in some bank in the US, and they effectively create shares based on those, that holding. So effectively there is like a mapping. That's sort of the thing that should happen also for OTC of shares that are trading elsewhere. So in that sense, but they are not ADRs in the sense that they, but the ADRs then trade on the market, and then they have to, you know, have disclosure rules and things like that. They have to follow the market. So that's sort of the thing.
Nice, I like it, mate. So yeah, that's a great summary. It's also why ADRs are different to normal stocks, as you say, as you asked, B. They're not that different. ADRs in particular are pretty. We have here CDIs, or chest depository interests, which work exactly the same way. So if you see CDI on the Australian market, same as ADR in the US market, they are a higher standard. As Doc says, the OTC market is not necessarily terrible, but you should expect lower levels of disclosure, probably equally then higher levels of risk. In the old days, as Doc also mentions, if you've got an American company that's on the OTC market, you used to call the pink sheets, and these are companies that didn't meet the listing requirements from the US. They were too small, too illiquid, they lost too much money, they didn't want to make the right disclosures, so it was always super, super scary, super dodgy. It was also where a lot of those pump and dump schemes were done because people could get away with it. So be a little bit careful, but as Doc says, if they are listed primarily elsewhere, that gives you a much greater sense of comfort. They're not as good as buying on the original exchanges, but I would... BMW is another company that trades on the OTC. I don't think, other than for brokerage reasons, as you say, I don't think I would avoid a quality overseas listed company on a good quality market like the European market or the UK or Australia or Singapore. If they happen to be listed on the OTC, I'd probably be okay with it. I don't think I'd avoid it necessarily other than for brokerage reasons. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, again, yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
On the $100 Japanese stock limit, that is absolutely arbitrary. It used to be the same in other countries, by the way. Australia used to have a round lot requirement of 500 shares at a time. Kind of probably goes back to the old pre-computer days, quite honestly, just to make it simple and easy for everybody and make the trades just you know, work better. It was kind of a bit arbitrary. I think it was just, I'm sure it was literally just administrative, you know, shortcut to make things simple. Japan has a really arcane system that the companies are listed by number rather than ticker, by alphabetical code. They also all report, I'm pretty sure they still do, on exactly the same day every year. So every company reports on the same day under Japanese either law or market regulation. So they haven't been quite as innovative and quite as flexible, fluid, as some of the other markets around the rest of the world. So, you know, it's not a big deal, really. I mean, it's a bit annoying, and it's a bit kind of not very retail investor friendly. So I'd rather they not have it than have it. But it is, whether it was 1, 10, 100, just an arbitrary number. As you say, it does absolutely stop individual retail investors buying some of these stocks. And we would, at the Motley Fool, and Doc and I individually, I'm pretty sure would agree that, and this stops retail investors getting access to the market, it's probably a bad thing, unless there's a really good reason for it. This one seems to be just an admin hangover from simpler days, pre-computer days. Doc, do you know any more about that than I do?
No, I think that's correct.
Beautiful. Let's go to a question from, well, I'm going to say Mr. Jones or Mrs. Jones. The email address is jones at something. I'm not going to go into detail on that one, but we didn't get a name with this one, mate. So to Mr. or Mrs. Ms. Jones, Master Jones, whoever you happen to be, the Jones family, for all I know, Dr. Jones, perhaps. Back to our comment a couple of weeks ago. Maybe you are a doctor. We'll call you Dr. Jones. Great podcast, says Dr. Jones. Looking forward to listening every weekend. And Ivan, thanks for opening my eyes to the Asia Tigers ETF. It has been on a serious run since you first started talking about it. Nice work, Doc. Dr. Jones says, I'm interested in your feedback on Hum, the old Flexi Group. It's a cash flow positive buy now, pay later company that has missed all the BNPL hype! Exclamation mark. It's kind of a question, kind of a comment. Flexi Group is one we recommended at Share Advisor years ago, and it's been a really terrible performer. And I have to say, mate, it's one of those stocks where, for the value people like maybe Dr. Jones here, are looking at it going, hang on, Afterpay is $1 billion worth of market cap. There's Zip and Sezzle and I can't even think of the other ones. So OpenPay, Splitit, whatever I'm missing. And this poor old Flexi Group, now called Hum, because apparently that's cooler. That's the name of their buy now, pay later products. So if in doubt, rebrand. You're kind of going to go, how is it possible that this thing that's actually cash flow positive, actually making money, can't buy a friend? And the guys that are losing, maybe it's not losing enough money. Have you looked at Hum/Flexi Group, mate? You are someone who's looked and spent a lot of time looking at those buy now, pay later players. What's wrong with Hum?
You know what? I've not really looked very closely at Hum and its execution in the buy now, pay later space to have actually an opinion. So I'll pass it on to you. You've looked at it.
I have. We actually bought it years and years and years ago. And back in the day, Its main business was those interest-free credit cards, the Harvey Norman kind of, you know, 3 years, no interest type stuff. And it's – so here's the thing. I think what investors need to be careful of, value investing in particular, and I don't class myself really as a value or a growth guy. I'm kind of somewhere in between, kind of growth at a reasonable price if you make me put myself on some sort of spot. Although we have done the occasional value play in Share Advisor, so I sometimes hark back. The value investor deep inside me sometimes gets out. So it looks like it should be attractive, right? And it probably should be. What I think is important, though, is that like, you know, all banks aren't worth the same, or all miners aren't worth the same, or retailers aren't worth the same, there's just been a great and a good retailer. You can say, well, hang on, that's in the supermarket space, or it's in the discretionary retail space. Surely it should be worth more. And that kind of is true as at a business level in terms of a starting point. You know, how is – but the better question on Humm, rather than saying why is Humm not worth more – the better question in this case, I think, is why is Humm not doing a better job of actually executing its business? And Doc mentioned the E word, and that was exactly the word I was going to mention, because you know what? Humm was there first. Flexgroup was there. Flexgroup was buy now, pay later. It literally invented the, well, not invented the category, but effectively invented the category, right? Post-lay-by. Flexgroup, this Certegy easy pay thing you might have seen, which was the world's worst brand, which is part of the problem, was around for years. Like when my wife and I first got together, she had bought a fridge or a sofa using one of those buy now, pay no interest over 4 years things. So that's going back at least a decade. They were here so much earlier. The difference is they didn't execute well. They allowed the retailer to drive the purchase, and that's fine. This is a decent business, right? It's not a dead business, not a terrible business, but they served the need. They were the oil or the grease that made the thing work. What Afterpay, Zip and others have done is they've actually gone out to the consumer first. And then to the retailer says, hey, everybody, come and use this. Look how easy it is. It's on an app. You can scan it. You can, you know, use it online. They simply executed on the concept in a far, far, far better way than Flexgroup ever did, much to its chagrin, right? And there's plenty of those examples. Beta Max is probably a great example with videos, right? Beta was the first, arguably still by many people, the best quality video storage kind of, you know, tape. VHS flew straight past it because it executed better. You know, no one's using VHS anymore. Why did Beta not win the war? Because it simply wasn't the most adopted. It didn't do the best job of getting in people's hands and becoming the next big thing. Now, it turns out there were very specific reasons which aren't overly family friendly, but suffice it to say, those who make videos for adult consumption apparently all used VHS, and allegedly that's why VHS won the war, but that may be an apocryphal story. In any case, you know, so execution matters a lot, and Flexgroup just missed it. They just missed it outright. Yes, if you go to Harvey Norman, you might use Flexgroup or Humm to buy your lounge, and that's great, and they'll make some money off it, and that's all fantastic, but they didn't go broad enough, wide enough, big enough, and in the right way. They didn't make it cool and, frankly, sexy enough that people wanted to grab it, take it off the shelf, and so, you know, it's a shame for Flexgroup shareholders, it's a shame for the company. Management's changed two or three times since Afterpay turned up, so we can't blame any of the current group, but they're desperately trying to catch up now, realizing that they just simply let Afterpay walk straight past them. In a way that, you know, I think shareholders will rue for a very, very, very long time. There is no reason Flexgroup couldn't have been Afterpay or at least something similar had they been quick enough, innovative enough, and executed well enough to join that crew. Any other thoughts on that, mate?
I have nothing to add.
Hey, a question from Ash. Hi, Scott. I listened to your podcast at the beginning of the year. I'm still thinking of buying Big Tin Can, Treasury or Kogan. Not sure which one I'd be best to get, or should I get all of them? Also, reading about the NASDAQ 100 ETF, do you have this one? I haven't read much about ETFs before now. He says, Mum thinks I should be keeping my money for a house, but I'm not getting shares all the time and just looking at a few you guys recommend. Have seen you on TV a few times. Thanks, you do a great job, Scott. Thank you, Ash. That's very, very kind. Mate, my first piece of advice is always listen to your mum. I'm not going to come on this podcast and disagree with your mother because, frankly, mothers are scary, scary people when they don't like you, and I like your mum, and I hope your mum likes me. That's all I have to say. Doc, you can annoy Ash's mum. What do you think?
I'm not going to disagree with her mom.
All right. So the question was Treasury, Kogan, or Big Tin Can. Should I buy one of them? Which one should I get? Or should I get them all? And also, whether you asked for me, I'll answer that as well. But the NASDAQ 100 ETF. Do you have thoughts on any or all of those?
Well, I like Big Tin Can. I like Kogan. I like the NASDAQ 100 ETF. I like, you know, again, I know you like Treasury. So, I mean, sometimes, you know, just a little bit of everything and just being patient can be actually a good recipe, right? I mean, that's the only thing I'll say. But again, you know, Ash's mom's advice is not to buy anything and put into a house. So that's that. But I like, you know, like Yeah, that's there are many ways to do this, and you know, one way to do this is to buy a little bit of everything, and that's fine.
Yeah, I think that's right, mate. I own units in the NASDAQ 100 ETF. I own shares in Kogan and Treasury, so put that down as I'm long and therefore biased, but also my money's where my mouth is, so I think those are market-beating investments. I don't own Big Tin Cam, but I know you're a big fan, so I'd happily, on the back of Doc's own recommendation, buy those shares as well. Look, generally, like everything, we can't tell you, Ash, what you should buy, but as a broad idea, diversification is good. So, you know, just one, I mean, you've got a chance of a, you know, to use the computer code, you've got a one or a zero outcome, right? It's a binary outcome. You'll do well or badly. Generally speaking, particularly early on for people in their investing careers, we'd recommend being diversified as quickly as possible. So for what that's worth, go with that. Look, in terms of the house thing, we've talked lots about this in terms of general financial advice before, but as a matter of course, if you're going to need the money for the deposit sooner rather than later, then saving it makes more sense. I think you'll do better saving than cash in the bank. Of course, the bit we don't know is how fast house prices go up relative to shares, right? So at some point, if the house property market goes up faster than shares, you would have been better buying earlier rather than later. If shares go up faster than property, then you're better off putting money in shares and saving it. I wish I knew the answer to that, because if I did, I'd know where to put my money. But we can't unfortunately know that. I feel better about shares long term, but if you're going to buy a house eventually, then you might need to do your own calculus and just work out what makes most sense there. And again, we love your mum, so please tell your mum hi from us. All right, question from Charles, Doc. Dear Scott and Doc, I thoroughly enjoyed listening to the podcast all the way over here in Surrey in the UK. Thank you, mate. I've been a long-time member of Doc's EO, Scott's share advisor, and Ed's dividend investor. Something for everybody. Thanks, Charles. All of which have ensured my portfolio has consistently and significantly outperformed the market. Man, we've got to get Doc on staff. He should be running our marketing. That said, he says, oh no, here we go. I am concerned, very concerned, about a monster that has not seriously appeared in a long time. In fact, so long that many younger investors have never experienced the impact of inflation. I am particularly concerned that when inflation increases, it increases fast, especially as governments around the world are printing money like there is no tomorrow. I am concerned, says Charles, because so many of my best stocks recommended in EO are quite leveraged, and some quite heavily. So my question to you two gurus is, what do you think the impact of inflation may be? And which stocks do you think could be adversely impacted by rising inflation? I very much look forward to hearing from you. Regards, Charles. Doc, that's a really great one, because I'm old enough and ugly enough to remember when inflation was the bogeyman. It was the only thing that mattered for such a long time. I went through high school economics learning about stagflation, which was high inflation and stagnant economic growth. That was the battle of the 70s and 80s. And there was some sense that in the early 90s, maybe-ish, post the 91 recession here in Australia, the feeling was, as Paul Keating famously said, it was the recession we had to have because rates were jacked up to basically cool the economy and stop the runaway inflation. But post then, around the rest of the world, effectively, at least the Western world, there's been bugger all inflation, which has been wonderful, at least in theory. Now, whether there's too little inflation leading to the current problem is an open question. But as Charles says, mate, the return of inflation is something that we should at least be thoughtful about. And I actually agree with him. If and when it does return, it may come back quite quickly, and it may well be the case that A, central bankers are too slow to respond, but B, it may hurt our company. So firstly, I suppose I should ask you what you think of Charles' idea, but then even whether you agree or disagree, if it was to happen, what do you think of some of the companies that we recommend and how they would fare in a higher inflation environment?
Yeah, so one of the things that was not clear to me from Charles' comment is that he basically said, I'm concerned because some of my best stock recommended in extreme opportunities are leveraged and yes, quite heavily so. So I'm not sure what he means by leveraged. I mean, many of these companies are not, they don't have debt on the balance sheets. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what he means here by leverage. That part is not really clear. In fact, you know, if there is inflation and interest rates really have to go up, it doesn't materially impact the functioning of these businesses because they don't really have that kind of debt, that the debt payments have to, you know, don't have to go up. I guess, you know, the growth rates might be affected, but that's going to be affected for everyone. So again, I don't know. I mean, it's a genuine concern, but I'm not sure how it's specific to, you know, like if you're a software company, you're a software company. If you're a SaaS company, you're a SaaS company.
Let's segue away from AEO companies and particularly, specifically, mate. Your thoughts on the potential for inflation to return and what you would think if you owned companies that had a decent amount of leverage on the balance sheet?
Yeah, so a couple of things, right? I mean, if companies have exposure to a consumer-driven economy and so let's say interest rates have to go back to 5%. Mm-hmm. And I have a mortgage to pay, then if I've, you know, if my mortgage also equivalently goes up with the base rate now being 0.1% to, like, you know, 5% or whatever, 4%, that's a 4 or 5% increase to my cost. If my cost goes up that much, well, I have to cut back somewhere, right? So, I mean, that's the, the consumer driven economy would suffer, which in turn then, of course, may likely impact, you know, enterprises and businesses. So, I mean, there's a flow-on effect for everything. But I would be most concerned about things like retailers and banks and stuff like that. Anything with heavy leverage would be the ones I would be concerned with. Like, the reason I'd be concerned with is businesses that have basically a large cost for operation. Mm-hmm. If their cost basis goes up, they really need to work really hard to make profit. So basically, the profits deplete. And if the profits deplete at the same time as consumers stop spending, then it's like a double whammy for them. So that's how I look at it. You know, how do you think about that? I guess
it's a really good question, mate. As a general rule, I worry that central bankers, and you have talked about this a lot of times, are being too accommodative. And right now, that's not leading to inflation. And there are very, very real structural reasons why we may not get inflation. We have been importing deflation, if you can follow my drift, from Asia and much of the developing world for probably 20 or 30 years. The ability to outsource the production of cheaper product elsewhere has actually, you know, a $20 Billabong t-shirt replaced with a $5 Kmart t-shirt. Is effectively deflation, right? And that happens because we close down the Billabong factory here, we use workers who are employed for much, much, much lower wages elsewhere, and we buy that shirt. And so the cost of clothing falls as a result. Flow that through the rest of the economy, that's a big, big, big deal, as well as the fact, by the way, that things like computers keep getting cheaper, cars keep getting, if not cheaper, at least we get a whole lot more for the car we're buying. The price of a Camry has probably hardly moved in 20 years, and yet if you put the two cars side by side, you'd be blown away by how much better the new ones are. That's not even including the Teslas of the world, who are just phenomenally different, right? So think all that stuff through. Look, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, 10 years ago, would 0.1% interest rates lead to massive inflation? I would have said yes, absolutely. And they haven't yet. But as Charles says, Doc, you know, if and when it starts to rear its ugly head, it's gonna accelerate away. It is probable, or at least very, very possible. So it's worth thinking about, and it's worth being prepared for. I don't think you need to be super, super prepared in advance for it, in the sense that as you see it coming, it's going to be fast, but it won't be overnight. So if we get to a situation where we go, hey, all of a sudden inflation's 2%, then 2.5%, then 3%, then 3.5%, during that journey, we've got plenty of time to make different decisions around selling some companies that we own if we need to. So I think you should start being mentally prepared, but I wouldn't make any decisions now, certainly now, on those decisions or those companies, because you don't need to guess that far ahead. So be slow. In terms of the companies that are impacted, as Doc says, high debt companies are a massive problem. I'd be super mindful of businesses that are effectively debt with businesses attached rather than businesses with debt. And by that I mean things like, say, Sydney Airport, Transurban, some of the big pipeline infrastructure businesses that are predicated on certain interest rates. They won't go broke necessarily, but if you imagine their biggest cost is interest, and that goes up, while they can't increase prices fast enough, that will crimp profits, and so that would hurt share prices. So be careful of that sort of stuff. Stuff with super amounts of debt, super important that you keep an eye on that. On the flip side, the other thing is, so playing, I don't like the word offense, a very American term, playing attack rather than just defense. The other thing to think about is the business that will benefit from that. And if you have an inflation, you want business with pricing power, businesses that can put their prices up should they need to. And they generally are businesses that have some sort of competitive advantage or point of difference. So you don't necessarily want to be, a commodity company can't put its prices up, right? If you're a miner with a lot of debt, you can't put the price of coal up just because you want to, or the price of iron up just because you want to. You need to find a way to cut your costs, or frankly, just accept lower profits. If you're a branded product company that has pricing power, then you've got room to put prices up. And again, speaking of Tesla, Tesla wants to put its price up 10 grand. Would it meaningfully impact sales? Probably not. Coke can put its price up 20 cents a can. Would it impact sales meaningfully? Probably not. you know, plenty of others beside between those two examples. They're pretty extreme examples, right? Coke and Tesla. Think about the per unit price of their product. It's, I don't get much bigger than that. But yeah, look for pricing power would be my honest answer. Doc, any more thoughts? Have I spurned any ideas? You disagree or agree with anything I said?
No, I have nothing actually to add.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
So, mate, let's go to another question. And this time the question comes from, okay, sorry, Glenn. Hi, guys. I'm interested in investing in Tencent, the Chinese company. Such an interesting company. My research quickly became confusing, though. Direct investment, this is in the Hong Kong listed business, is expensive. Other methods include the ADR, TCEHY, or NASPERS, or its subsidiary process. Man, we're getting detailed here. These two options are like Russian dolls to Tencent and are unsuccessfully always trying different ways of matching Tencent's value. So they're trying to basically, trying to mirror it. Perhaps this is a value opportunity. Do you have advice on investing in Tencent, the best method, and also what do you think of ADRs? Thanks and full on, Glenn. Doc, we've covered ADRs. What do you know about Tencent? What do you think? What do you care?
Oh, I know it's a fascinating business. It's one of the largest or the largest gaming companies. It's the owner of e-commerce online. It's got stakes in various companies around the globe. Many actually fast growing companies around the globe. So it's a fascinating company. I used to actually own shares which I sold, and after I sold them, the shares have done actually really well. So that's that. Right now, I hesitate to invest in companies with direct China listing. Let me rephrase that. If you want to invest in a company which is listed, say, in Hong Kong, then I would buy the direct shares. Largely because there's been this, the scuffle going on or tussle going on between U.S. regulators and the Chinese regulators about disclosure rules and things like that. And, they have been, threatening to boot some companies off the U.S. exchanges. Well, those would mean that those ADRs have to be delisted. There's just a little bit of uncertainty. It seems that, though, that has actually not resulted in any meaningful impact on price.
Yeah, that's right. There was a whole lot of noise, right? But not much actually happened.
It seems like investors have basically decided, the only person that loses from this is the U.S. investors or investors who are invested in the U.S. market you remove these companies. So therefore, we don't care. And then there is, there's like companies that go bankrupt. But that is, whether it's a company from China or Hong Kong or from America or Australia, companies do go bankrupt. That's just the fact of life. There's that. But that's got nothing to do with this. So I don't know. I've been a bit skeptical. So one of the reasons I don't hold shares is just this regulatory thing bothers me. And when something bothers me, I say that, and then as has been rightly pointed out, you can buy the shares. So I would think that you could buy the shares in Hong Kong, but I think you have to buy the shares. There are a couple of things to remember. You have to buy them just like the Japanese market. The Hong Kong market, I believe, has a 100 share lot requirement.
Right. I didn't know that.
And brokerage is pretty expensive, actually, if you trade in Hong Kong, or maybe the broker seems to suggest it's very expensive. Yeah. Maybe it's not that expensive. So that caveat is important. And there is also something like a stamp duty and registration and stuff like that happens for shares.
Right, okay.
So again, this could be a broker-specific issue, not an exchange-specific issue. Yeah. So I think it's a very, very interesting company. That I have no doubt about. It's fast growing and it's excellent in certain areas. It's probably world leader, especially things with mobile payments and so on.
So fascinating.
Excellent company. My preference would be to buy direct listing of Hong Kong, not the ADRs or the OTCs available, but that's just me.
I think it makes sense. Also, some brokers don't have, you can access US market, not Hong Kong. There's other reasons as well. I've probably been just too, I don't know, I was going to say too risk averse. Maybe not. It depends on what happens next, right? As you say, I've been concerned about the willingness or ability or interest of the Chinese government to look after non-Chinese shareholders if they decided to simply change their minds. And there is a non-zero chance of a zero outcome at some point, right? Or some sort of meaningful dilution or pain as a result of a simple, you know, one stroke of the pen changes to Chinese government policy. So I've got to say, from that perspective, I've looked at those companies, the Alibabas, the Tencents, the others, and kind of go, oh, look, I could. Do I really want to? And I've just kind of gone, you know what, I'll give it a miss. Just one of those, for me, it's been a too hard basket thing. Maybe I'm being, I said, too risk averse or too worried or whatever. I don't think China's the bogeyman, by the way, but I'm also mindful of things that they have done or can do. And as you've already mentioned, the fact that other countries can also take unilateral action in reverse. I don't know. Maybe it'd be too bold a move to meaningfully hurt people who invested in these companies from outside China in terms of the relationship that China has with the rest of the world. But I don't know. I figure there's enough opportunities elsewhere without adding the sovereign risk to the equation. Is that too risk averse, do you reckon?
No, I think, again, this is very, like, these are individual decisions, right? I mean, everything has a risk, right? And you're deciding in this particular case that risk is important to you. Mm. And I think that's a very legitimate way to think about stuff, right? I mean, if it's risky for you, then that. And there are you know, there are thousands of other opportunities. Well, you know, you can pick something else. So again, this is individually. You have to each individual has to sort of decide what to do. Yeah.
Nice. Great. Mate, a very different question from Seth. This one's about portfolio construction. Seth says, hello, Scott and Dr. Mahanti. Greetings from Florida. Now, look, Seth, you're going to call him Dr. Mahanti. That's fair enough. But at least call me Mr. Phillips. Come on. Bit of respect. No, I'm kidding. Greetings from Florida, says Seth. I hope this email finds you well. I wanted to start off by saying thank you for all that you've done. By sharing both your combined insights and investment wisdom, you have benefited so many people, in brackets, more than you might know. Myself included. Thank you, Seth. I'm a relatively inexperienced investor, 22 years old. You have our eternal jealousy, Seth. I wish I was 22 again. I just graduated from college in May 2020, where I studied biomedical science. Very cool. Regrettably, I did not take a single finance class throughout my time in college, and I've just recently started learning how to judge companies and build my own portfolio. I started in November 2020. That's pretty cool, mate. Well done. I began listening to Motley Fool Money and Rule Breaker Investing around the same time, and I now listen to Motley Fool podcasts on my commute to work every morning. Listening has been incredibly useful for me in understanding the fundamentals of investing and forming new ideas. I understand it's meant as specific investment advice. Thank you, Seth. You're up with our legal requirements here in Australia. It has allowed me to model my portfolio goals and shape logical rationales behind each of my stock picks. Nice work, mate. You're picking this up super fast. I have started with a diverse set of companies that I believe in, which are also companies I can see a logical path for long-term success with. I plan to buy more shares of each of these companies every month over several years to grow my portfolio. As of now, the total value of my portfolio is still relatively low. I own shares in just 12 stocks and 2 ETFs. I'm writing to you now in the hopes that I might hear both of your opinions on two general concepts about building my portfolio. Here we go. My first question is based on the advantages, if any, of owning ETFs. Do you consider the potential decrease in risk to be worth the potential decrease in positive returns? For example, I own shares in Cybersecurity ETF, which is code HACK or HACK, because I believe it is logical to assume that your cybersecurity industry will grow as world technology advances. However, I'm frequently debating whether I should just sell my ETF shares and buy shares of the most successful cybersecurity company instead. I understand that holding the ETF lowers the chance that an individual company will hurt my portfolio, but this would also mute any major positive gains that a single successful company might make. Do you know of any metrics or ideas that one might use to rationally compare the risk-reward of owning an ETF versus company stocks? Love that question. I'll hold the second one, Doc, because it's a long question, the first one. So we'll deal with that one first rather than confuse ourselves. So it's a really great question. ETFs have all their wonderful advantages, but you're going to get the average return of either a whole market or, in this case, a whole industry. And that's great because you don't miss out on the upside. You also, though, you know, miss the downside, which is great. On the flip side, you don't necessarily get the best return from that group. You're getting the average of that group. Is there value instead in selling that and buying the companies themselves?
I think it really depends on source of information, the amount of research you're doing, the level of comfort you've got, because the most important thing is comfort. If you're comfortable with what you're doing, then that'll enable you to sort of ride through downturns and, you know, pullbacks and things like that, because most of the time people don't make good returns because they're probably buying the right investment vehicles, but they're probably selling at the wrong time, right? And I think that is sort of the key. The other thing is that if you are, like, you know, I'm gathering he's in the US and you are investing in the US market, you have access to all these companies. Well, do you really need to invest? If you are an active investor, you don't really need to invest in those ETFs because you can potentially find those companies. For for an Australian investor who's not directly investing in the US, a hack is probably a very, very good way to get exposure to that sector, that market, and those sort of, you know, the top flight cybersecurity companies, right? We have Hack as a recommendation in Motley Fool Pro, largely for that reason. It provides us, you know, a bit of diversification. It provides us sort of even hedge, because it is hedged, you know, it's in a different currency and things like that, and provides access. And the final thing I'll say about these ETFs, a lot of these ETFs that are sector specific, they do have an upside, not an upside, but a position size cap on how large a holding gets. So one of the problems that you would see is that it, as a particular company, for example, does really well, it gets sold off. And one of the things happens with the hack, you know, we get this question quite often from our members is, well, how come hack has a dividend of 10%? Like there'll be you know, sometimes hack's dividend is like 15% annually. Right. And that's, you know, you think, how come this is 15%? Like the largest, I think the largest dividend payer is something like 3%, and that's Cisco. Right. And that's because they're selling down positions to match their, match up their mandate, which says you can't hold particular company to be larger than this allocation. So that's how your upside. I mean, the hack ETF has done really well for us here. But again, if you're an active investor and have access to those securities, then you are better off, in my opinion, to at least investigate the option of investing in individual. So the last point, I think this is where it becomes tricky. Hack, say, has 40 companies. You, as an individual, you're not going to invest in 40 companies. You're going to probably invest in four. So you really need to know what you're picking to sort of make it work for you. And maybe the other way to think about this is that you could pick the best in class cybersecurity company. And I'd call them basically, that'll be software, hardware, software companies. If you pick the best in class, you know, a cloud company, pick the best in class, data science company, pick the best in class, whatever. That sort of portfolio will do really well. It'll be volatile, but again, picking the best in class of something and putting it together in a portfolio does actually really well. So that's what I try to do. I'd pick the best in class I can find for a particular sector that I'm interested in, and then, you know, again, and I do look at the sort of the, I guess, the fundamental, call it unit economics, right? I mean, I want the business to have the ability to generate cash and be in a growing area, which I think cybersecurity is. And it can be actually cash generative because of the type of, you know, the way cybersecurity is now handled these days. So he's onto something here.
I like it, mate. I'm going to agree with all of that. I'm going to add a couple of thoughts, Seth, just to kind of round out some extra ideas, and we'll move on to your second question. First thing I'd say is I think Doc's absolutely right. The only couple of thoughts for me is almost amplifying a point Doc made, which is if you like the sector but you really don't feel like you have an advantage in picking the right stock in that area for whatever reason. Maybe you're an active investor but you just don't know enough about cybersecurity. So for me, for example, right, I would probably, in your case, go the ETF rather than the individual companies, because my chance of actually finding the best cybersecurity company with the time, effort, and energy I've got, with I'm doing everything else in my day job, including investing, by the way, because you know my time's focused on the ASX. If I really wanted exposure, I might say, hey, Doc, what do you reckon? It's probably what I do actually, and ask and buy whatever he recommended, but sort of that. That can make some sense. So if you don't feel like you've got domain expertise, but you want to buy it, I think that makes some sense. So there's opportunity there. You have to remember, of course, that like anything, the fewer anything you buy, the greater the chance you're going to get not a representative return, and that could be the wrong way, right? So when we recommend our companies here, Doc said before, Extreme Opportunities is 4 or 5 times out of 10 he's right. In other words, he's wrong about as often as he's right, sometimes even more. I'm probably right about 6 times out of 10, which is still reasonably low. If I was going to pick a cybersecurity company, one, the chance I'm right is probably less than half, right? Or maybe just on half. That's okay, because the rest of my portfolio is diversified. So you don't need to be right on every idea. I might have a retailer I get wrong and a miner I get right, or vice versa. And that's okay. So at a portfolio level, you don't have to get each segment right. But just be mindful that if you are trying to pick the winner in a given industry, there's just a chance you'll be wrong. And that's okay, right? Completely okay. Just acknowledge and accept that's going to be true. And if that's not something you want to do, then again, the ETF would make some sense for you. But otherwise, completely agree with Doc. Second question from Seth. My second question involves the importance, if any, of having geographically diverse assets. As I look through my list of companies, I realize that other than Mercado Libre and Sony, all of my stocks are based in the US. Maybe I'm overthinking it, he says, but I feel having most of my investments with companies in the US makes my portfolio very vulnerable to any kind of economic failure that might occur here. For example, if a drastic change in national policy or major incident harmed the general American marketplace, then 90% of my portfolio would be destroyed. For this reason, I've been looking to Chinese and Australian stocks to buy for more diversity. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on the subject. Would you consider having too many stocks of companies concentrated in a single country a high-risk portfolio? What do you reckon, mate?
Well, I have a lot of U.S. stocks in my portfolio. Here's the, I think, the way to think about this. You can buy an Australian company or you can buy, You can buy a company listed in Australia or you can buy a company listed in America or you can buy a company listed in, Johannesburg, right? What you really need to look at is where the revenues are coming from. So if you're buying a company, effectively, if they're a multinational, their revenues are going to be, from multiple nations around the world. So that, I think that's the bottom line. Yes, there can be short-term hiccups. Here's the other thing. I think that's, this is true for the American market, but not true for other markets. If there is a sort of a big system-wide issue with the American financial market, that is going to flow through to the other world markets. If there is a problem in the Australian financial market, that's not going to actually flow through to the American market. In that sense, you can consider. So you can't really hedge out the American risk, at least at this point in time. If something happens to the American market, well, I think every market around the world is going to get impacted just because of the way the world market kind of works right now. I wish there was a way to hedge that, but I don't know how you hedge it. So that's my thought. So again, I think I would focus more on revenue, not where the company's listed. I would also look, and he pointed out Mercado Libre. So that's interesting, right? Because that's companies listed in I believe in NASDAQ in the US. And I own Mercado Libre shares. But its revenues are all from Latin America, which has its own risks, by the way, right? I mean, the hyperinflation, they report numbers in US dollars and then local currency. I mean, it can be completely miles apart. Like, 100% growth can turn into like negative growth. 100% growth in local currency could mean actually negative growth in US dollars, for example, right? Yeah. So in some sense, actually going out to a new market and buying Mercado Libre can actually introduce higher risks. Again, depends on how you want to think about these things. But I think the first part, buy best in class and, best in class companies with diversified revenue sources, I think that's a pretty good strategy. By all means, buy Australian stocks. We have plenty in our services. You're more than welcome to look at them. Same thing. I mean, if you have a good source for looking for the China-based companies, by all means. I mean, again, I think you want to buy the companies that on a relative basis give you the best upside potential. And need to consider, I guess, currency as well. But over long term, that shouldn't really impact that much, but again, I don't know. And that's it.
Nice one, mate. I'll completely agree. We very really disagree on this sort of stuff. I think it's funny, Seth, the context and kind of perspective is really important, right? So to one point, as you're saying, should I invest more internationally for more diversification? Doc's saying exactly equally and oppositely. On the other hand, investing internationally adds risk, right? And those are both the same, different sides of the same coin, because it depends on where things go and what impacts the industries, the currencies, the countries, the companies that you are investing in matters a whole lot. This is a super old stat now. I've got to find a new version of it because I've been saying the same thing probably for 5 years. Last time I saw some numbers, it literally was maybe five, maybe even longer ago, years ago, something like 40%+ of the S&P 500's revenues, not necessarily profits, revenues, came from outside the US. So investing in US companies is truly investing in the world. And so to Doc's point, if you said, okay, 90% of my companies are based in the US, that's true. But if you said, well, actually, hang on, but 45% of my portfolio's revenues come from overseas, that gives you a very, very different perspective. Now, that might not be enough, by the way, for what it's worth. And that's a question for you to answer. Australians have a much bigger problem because we are 2% of the world's markets and most of our money is here. At least in the US, it's your markets are half the world's markets. And so, you know, maybe half your money is there. Whether you think having half your money exposed to the US where you have your job and home and car and relationships is the right thing for you is probably an open question. As I said, I think it's a much bigger issue and an unaddressed issue, by the way, for most Australians, far more than it is for you. But the same rationale and rules would apply, right? Do you want to have all of your physical assets plus half your, you know, invested assets invested in one country with, you know, revenue coming from one country? It won't be a 90% destruction, to use your term, but it might be, you know, something. At some point, you know, England stopped being the major economy in the world and became the US, and there was more opportunity investing in the US than England. So for English people who had this conversation, I don't know, 80 years ago, Doc, I suppose, 100 years ago, whatever it was, you know, they may have missed out on better opportunities elsewhere. So I wouldn't assume that, you know, the way things are now will always stay the same. I would say, for what it's worth, I love that you're asking the question. I don't think, given the diversity you've already got, it's actually one of the bigger issues to deal with. So if I was in the US investing most of my money there in companies that had most of their operations outside or at least a decent proportion outside the US, I'd feel pretty diversified and pretty good about that. Anything to add, Doc?
I have nothing to add.
Beautiful. He says, I finished off with saying, my apologies in advance if my questions are too simple, low level. They're not. They're some of the best questions, mate, that we get. Or if they are questions you've answered in the past. We may have done that, to be fair, but it doesn't hurt to do it again. We have plenty of new listeners. Once again, thank you for all you've done. Your insightful conversations and subtle disagreements make for a very informative podcast, which allows me to form my own ideas and be more confident in my investment decisions, mate. That's what we're trying to do. I know in a few decades, I'll be glad that I followed through with some of these investments. Full on, Seth. Thank you, mate. Mate, question from Denim. Hi, Scott and Doc. Loving the weekly podcast on the Thursday and the not-so-special mailbag edition on Sunday. And he has one of those crying, laughing faces, so I assume he's having a subtle dig and maybe a laugh with us rather than at us. He says, I appreciate all you do for the little guys like myself. I'd like to get your thoughts on Cedar Woods Properties. CWP is the ASX code. Thanks and keep up the great work. Regards, Denim. Doc, I'm gonna assume that a property company is not something you've looked at in a little while. Is that a fair assumption?
No, I'm gonna disappoint Denim by saying that, mate, I have not looked at Cedar Woods. It has not even shown up on any of my screens.
Property as a service or no?
I have no idea whatever this thing is, but you know, maybe it's interesting. I'm not saying it's not interesting, but it's not a type. You know, the moment it has the word property in it, you know, my sort of various red flags start flashing to my detriment. But
they play recurring revenue. These guys have tenants. They you know, they pay the bills. That's recurring revenue. 100% retention of customers in a 12-month period. That's got to be pretty good, doesn't it?
Well, until the government says you don't have to pay rent, and you can't be evicted. Yeah,
that is part of the problem. Look, Denim, I'm not super close to it, mate. I have to say, it is one of those companies that was often a favorite of plenty of retail investors. Certainly, one of those names that's been around forever. I remember when I first started investing, people saying we should look at it. Largely, for those who don't spend a lot of time on it, urban land subdivision redevelopment, that kind of stuff is Cedar Woods' business. I'm reading the summary here from the website. The national portfolio is 34 projects with more than 9,000 land, townhouse, apartment, and commercial products. So plenty of diversification across that residential development area. Here's the challenge, Denim. It's a PE of 28 and a price to book of 1.6 times. Neither of those are necessarily statistically particularly cheap. Doesn't mean it can't do well. The shares have more than doubled over the last 12 months. Not 12 months, actually, though. 12 months ago, pre-COVID, they've certainly doubled as a result of the COVID stuff. I just don't have a strong investment view, mate. Nothing there strikes me as super attractive. I don't know that I love the idea of wanting to be in residential property investment or development at scale. Certainly, the price has been a bit all over the place. It's a reasonable high, so you know they're doing something right. But it doesn't strike me on the numbers or the industry as something super high potential. But again, I was going to say like Doc. I've given a little bit more time because it is to some degree, at least in some of the ranges of some things I tend to look at from time to time. I don't do a lot of property. I don't do a lot of listed investment trusts or developers for those reasons. But if you know more about it, mate, feel free to jump in board. But I probably would give that one a miss myself. A question from Sam. Hi, Scott and Doc. We know there are two forms of returns from investing in the share market: dividends and capital growth. Generally, he says, growth stocks will not pay dividends. So we rely on capital growth upon selling in future when the market values the business at more than it does today. Nailing it. That's a great explanation, Sam. For a buy and hold long-term investing philosophy as advocated by yourselves, what is the end game for growth stocks in your portfolio? Love this question. Are you intending to hold for so long that you then expect them to commence paying a dividend? What if the company has no intention to ever pay a dividend? Would this influence your initial purchase decision? Thanks, Sam. There you go, mate. That's a nice one. I really like the way Sam's thinking this through. Your thoughts?
I mean, I don't buy them with an expectation that they're going to pay a dividend. I mean, if my shares appreciate a lot and I need to, you know, sell some to get, you know, an income, that's fine. It's okay if they don't pay, you know, don't pay a dividend. I think, you know, I wouldn't stress over that.
Nice. So how do you think about the end game, mate? Is it selling down small amounts as you get close to retirement and want some income? I assume that's all you can do, right? Unless you're going to hold them till death and pass them on to your heirs. That's the only thing we can do, right? Sell small amounts or maybe large chunks and reinvest. Do you see a time where you would sell out all your growth shares and buy income stocks instead, or do you expect you'll just slice off small amounts of growth portfolios forever? How do you think about that bit?
Yeah, so right now, sort of been thinking about this a little bit over the past maybe sometime. I sort of think that the best holding period for growth companies probably is around maybe 10 to 15 years. That's okay. Where you're going to get, if you buy them at sort of the right point in time until they sort of start maturing and the growth rate slows down, that's the 10 to 15 years that you want to hold them. At which point, actually, I will sell them and I'll buy another growth company.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah. And maybe I won't invest the whole thing. But I think, you know, I always want to hold, you know, sort of the best in class growth companies, sort of buy them a little early and then hold them for like, you know, that 10, 15 year time period that I think where you get, you know, maybe 15, maybe 20 for the rare cases. But it is really hard to see how a company can continue excelling, you know, for at a high rate for that period of time, right?
You know, if you're 62, do you imagine yourself selling one of those growth companies that's mature and then buying something that gives you a dividend income and kind of then moving into an income phase of your life? Or do you expect you might buy another growth company and just maybe you know, for every $100 you sell, you reinvest 95 and keep five for paying the bills? Do you have a thought?
So what might happen is that some of these companies may be paying a dividend at that time, and that might be a consideration at that point. Okay. And if I'm looking for an income and if these companies are paying a dividend, do I really need to sell and stuff like that? So, I mean, that might be a consideration, but I mean, really, you can't make the type of returns that you can make via growth investing, via dividend investing. So if you're ultimately, what you need to really look at is your portfolio and the portfolio's value and returns, right? And if the value is high, then you can just take some, you know, money out of it as cash and just continue. So again, I think this has got a lot to do with style and things like that. So I don't envision right now transitioning to some form of dividend sort of thing, but you know, I might keep some shares. I need substantial market beating potential for a company to be held in the portfolio. Otherwise, I just don't want to hold it. So,
I like it, Matt. I thought about this a little bit. I'm getting old, and I have thought about this a little bit. I don't really have a formed thought. So, Sam, thanks for continuing to poke me on this one. Particularly in Australia, because of franked dividends, there's an argument at some point where mathematically there's a crossover between the return you want out of growth and the capital gains tax you'd pay on sale versus a stock or investment you didn't have to sell, but you could get income from and pay income at marginal tax rates and potentially fully franked income or partially franked income at even lower marginal tax rates. So there's a at some point, I could imagine myself going to an income first portfolio, never ever on tax grounds, but when you consider the after-tax implications of either of those two strategies, there's a point at which you say, well, hang on, if I'm in the 30-cent tax bracket and I get fully franked dividend, I'm paying effectively no tax. The numbers don't quite work out that way, but work with me. If I pay zero tax on something versus 25% tax on a capital gain, assuming that I'm paying marginal tax and whatever, I guess it's 15% at that point, so depends how you want to do the maths, but there is a calculated return where you could effectively harvest, you know, non-taxed or very, very, very low tax dividends for decades, as opposed to having to pay capital gains and then reinvesting the difference and paying gains on that. It kind of depends on what level of capital growth you expect to be able to achieve, and what the trade-off would be, and also just simple things like, you know, not having to sell that if the market's down 40%, I wouldn't have wanted to have to sell a chunk of your portfolio last April to pay that year's bills, for example. So make sure you've got enough cash. So it's probably a broader retirement strategy. I think I'll end up doing a bit of both. I think I'll end up having some stocks that already do pay a dividend, by the way. So when the other thing is probably like everything, the artificial growth versus value or growth versus dividends isn't always the case. I've got some companies that pay a decent smallish dividend that are growing really nicely and probably will continue to. And so Doc's point, maybe the end result is actually that anyway, that as they mature, you simply don't necessarily have to sell them. You've made your money. You don't have to lock in the capital gain, but you can generate some income from that. That might be one way to do it as well. I gave you a plug on Friday, mate, so I'm going to give myself a plug today. Listeners, if you haven't yet taken the advice of many of your fellow questioners that we've read out today, you should join not only Extreme Opportunities, but Motley Fool Share Advisor. And you can do that by going to fool.com.au/SA podcast. As I've said before, not very original whether we name these URLs, so SA podcast, SA for Share Advisor. Little tip, if you want to join EO, just choose replace EO with SA with EO. But for now, we'll talk about Share Advisor. You can join Share Advisor. We try and find the best medium and large cap businesses we can on the ASX, generally with a bit of growth, sometimes a bit of value, sometimes a bit of both. Depends on how we're feeling on any given month. Thus far, we are still beating the market after almost 11 years doing this. And gee, it must be close to 100 plus recommendations by now. We do it because we love it, and we do it because we're trying to give you the best possible return we can in that sector of the market. There's plenty of options, and I wouldn't limit myself just to one Motley Fool service, of course. But if you want to get a start, or if you already have EO, go to fool.com.au and join Motley Fool Share Advisor. That's fool.com.au/SA podcast. Andrew Leggett and I run that service. We do our level best to help you beat the market. As I said, so far so good. But as I always say, past performance is still no guarantee. All right, mate, we're done. We've knocked out more than an hour, actually. We've gone a little bit over time, but hopefully some really great answers because the questions were fantastic. Let us know. And if you do like the answers, if you do like the podcast, please do subscribe. Make sure you leave us a review and a rating. 5 stars would be lovely if you wouldn't mind. Helps other people find the podcast. It helps us also just rise to the top of the pile when it comes to people looking for new podcasts they might want to look at, and getting some responses from other listeners to get a sense of what they're getting for their, well, not their money, for their time when it comes to listening to their favorite podcast. We hope Motley Fool Money is one of your favorites. And of course, don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness and some marketing from us by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll see you on Friday with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.